Good evening.
Hi, good evening.
Hello.
Morning.
Morning.
Hi.
How's everybody?
We are fine.
Good, thank you.
Thank you.
Super. Let me get my notes here. I'm in Tucson this morning.
Oh.
And discovered that with a different computer, that I didn't know my password, so that's why I'm a little late. And we have a guest here this morning, too.
Uh-huh.
Her name is Anna.
Welcome.
Hi, Anna.
Hi.
Okay, so we're in class 10 already. Wow.
Wow.
And you're all still here.
Yes.
So the topic for this class is how ignorant desire triggers another life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we finished the last class with a syllogism. It was consider the mind of a normal person at the moment of death. That mind will cross the line into a future mind because the mind possesses desire. So, why is this a valid proof to a Charvaka? It seems they wouldn't believe any part of this, so it seems like this can't be a valid proof to them. So to examine the proof, we go to the Wheel of Life. If you studied the Wheel of Life, you'll know something about this, and if you haven't, you'll learn something about it. Now, link number 2 of the 12 links, the picture on the Wheel of Life is a man making pots. And as we mentioned in the last class, you know, this represents the making of karma. And we call this immature karma. You'll hear other translations of it in other presentations, but in our immediate tradition with Geshe Michael, it's immature karma, meaning that it's just sitting there as a cause. It isn't yet ripening into a result. And this immature karma has to be ripened somehow in order to produce its result. And then we go to link number 7. And the picture in the Wheel of Life is a man with an arrow stuck in his eye. And this represents feeling or sensation. What this link represents is the development of our sense powers. And then link number 8, the picture here is of a woman pouring wine into a man's cup. And basically, it's a picture of feasting, you know. We have this expression in the United States, pigging out, you know, eating. And this link is called craving. We want things. We crave them. one of the things that we crave that we don't normally think about is that we crave, we desire things to exist from their own side. And this is wired into us. Every perception we have that ripens contains this element of seeing things as coming from their own side, of as having self-existence, of coming from no cause other than themselves. And then link number 9, the picture is usually a monkey grabbing for fruit. he's in a tree and he's grabbing for some fruit in a tree, like an apple tree or pear tree or apricot tree or something like that. And this link is called grasping. And link number 10, the picture is normally a pregnant woman. And sometimes it's a man and a woman lying together. And this link is called becoming or existence. And in our tradition, we call it ripe karma, meaning the karma of number 3 made potent. It's the karma of number 2, actually, made potent. It's the result of the cause in number 2. The karma from number 2 is whatever we think, say, or do. But this karma can't do a thing until it's triggered. And link number 10, what it does is it triggers another life. And then link number 11, link 11 is triggered in link 10. And what it is a birth or a rebirth. And this is link number 11. And it's usually pictured by a woman giving birth. Now, why doesn't birth come after link number 2? Something has to make the karma potent, and something has to trigger the immature karma of link number 2. And that something is links number 8 and 9, desire and grasping. So now we see how, from Master Dharmakirti's point of view, how the mind of this flops over into the next life. So links number 8 and 9 are the trigger for future samsaric lives. And Master Dharmakirti's whole argument here, then this was proof number 10 that we started the class with today, is that desire is the mind craving and grasping at the time of death. And it leads to karma ripening into a result. And that result is rebirth in samsara. So it might be a good idea to understand what craving and grasping are, since we want to eliminate them. So link number 8 is craving. And it means, the Tibetan means to cling to or to be attached to. And it can be translated as desire, but we use the word craving. Why? Because in link 7, we experience an object. We have sensation of it. We have feeling regarding it. And in link number 8, we don't want to be separated from the feeling. So we crave the object. It's more specific than desire. And it takes in the definition. It means the definition, which is to cling to. We cling to something. We don't want to give it up. You can think of a baby clinging to its mother, maybe, something like that. But we do that to things that we encounter, especially things that we like. We don't want to give them up. So we get to link number 8, not only from link number 7, but from the first 7 links in as well. We are born, and after being born, link numbers 1 through 7 represent the development of the body and the senses. Now, remember that in this context, body and senses can be considered the same thing. They are living tissue, and we've talked about that. The Charvakas didn't have any problem with living tissue. So from these first 7 links, we have the ability, we have the power to sense objects. You know, we have the ability and the power to experience them. And in link number 8, we don't want to be separated from that experience. So we crave to these objects. And it would be useful here to think that we cling to everything. We want to sense things. We want things around us. We are attached to the things around us. So we crave these objects. The entire development cycle here is that after birth, our sense organs develop, and we have contact with outside objects, you know, through the sense organs. And as a result of these contacts, we have consciousness growing from these contacts. And then these consciousnesses develop good and bad feelings related to the experience of the objects. And then we develop a desire not to lose those nice feelings. And that is link number 8. Almost all of what we do is centered on not wanting to be separated from the objects of these nice feelings. So we crave the objects that produce the nice feelings. And this is the trigger that ripens the immature karma of link number 2 into the ripened karma of link number 10, which is a mind in samsara, or a mind in one of the 6 levels of the desire realm. So if we could get rid of this, we wouldn't have to take rebirth in samsara. And this is according to the Wheel of Life now. And that was one of the first things that Lord Buddha taught, was the Wheel of Life. So this mental state of not craving objects is the state of an arhat, somebody who has eliminated all of their mental afflictions. Now that we know what craving is, there are 3 kinds of craving. The first one is, in Tibetan, dushe, and it means literally desire craving. And this craving desires not to lose its attractive object. And the second kind of craving is jikshe, which literally means fear craving. And this is a craving that wishes to avoid unpleasant objects. And the third kind of craving is sishe, which literally means existence craving. And this is craving for yourself because, you know, at the time at the moment of death, you fear that you are ending. And the moment of death, we crave for me because we have fear that our existence is ending. And this last kind of craving is interesting. It's part of the phrase, the wheel of life, the wheel of existence, the wheel of becoming. This last type of craving is particularly strong in the last moment of life. When an airplane is crashing, for example, you hear screaming on the tapes. You know, people think their existence is ending, and they fear it. They crave their existence. So link number 8 is the 3 types of craving, and we have them all the time, but the last one is especially strong at the time of death. So let's talk about link number 9 in some detail now. The strong craving at the time of death intensifies, and we grasp, which is link number 9, to the me of this life. And this is actually what triggers the karma for link number 2 to ripen as a particular type of mind in the next life. There's a verse in the reading that goes something like this. If it were the case that stopping the wrong view would stop your rebirths, then at the beginning of the path of seeing, you wouldn't have to take rebirth again. So one of the things here is called kitsota, which means the view of the perishable assembly. That's kind of a crazy translation. is sometimes translated as the view of the transitory collection. But what it is to grasp you or the things that are parts of you as self-existent. So when we are getting, we do this all the time, but it intensifies at the time of death. And we grasp to us, to me, you know, or the parts of me, which would include things that I own as well, as being self-existent, that they really come from their own side. And they can, by themselves, give me happiness. Or if I get rid of things I don't like, I will get rid of unhappiness. So the parts of you usually translate the Tibetan into me and mine. Now, mine doesn't refer to my house or my money or my family, but to the parts of me, like my arm, my mind, and so on. You know, you can determine the proper translation in German from this explanation, maybe. So this view is a mental function. And links number 11 and 12, link number 11 is a man carrying a burden. And link number 12 is a blind man with a stick. And they refer to this view, which is a wrong view. So this view is the villain, this view of the perishable assembly or whatever it is, this view of grasping to me and mine is the big villain that keeps us in samsara. It is what changes the immature karma at the time of death into a next rebirth. So, once you see emptiness directly, you enter the path of seeing, you see emptiness directly, and you come out of that experience with a different understanding of things. Things still appear to you to be self-existence. Your senses that sort of apply sense of self-existence to them. But you no longer believe that. You know that it's not true because you have understood in the path of seeing, in the direct perception of emptiness, that things have no nature of their own, that they are not self-existent. And you understand that. But this innate, this inborn grasping to things as self-existence has not been eliminated. Because if it were, how could there ever be a rebirth? According to the syllogism Master Dharmakirti has given us, he has demonstrated how, according to the wheel of life, this grasping at the time of death, grasping to me and mine at the time of death, leads to our next rebirth. It's like the material cause for the next rebirth. So somebody is arguing that this view cannot be the cause of rebirth in samsara because it would be eliminated by the path of seeing. That's why Master Dharmakirti is bringing this up. Somebody's objecting to what he said. And this obviously isn't true because one of the things you see in the path of seeing is how many rebirths you have left before enlightenment or nirvana. So simply dying without grasping isn't all there is to avoiding rebirths. What we must do is eliminate the seeing of ourselves as self-existent. And this isn't achieved on the path of seeing. Now, if you haven't had these explanations before, like for the wheel of life or what the five paths are, this is going to be kind of fuzzy to you. But take it up in your discussion groups. It'll become a little clearer. So there are four ways of perceiving a self, meaning yourself, okay? The first way is an unanalyzed, unchecked, conventional me, all right? What is me and mine? When I look in the mirror, I see Venerable Phil. Now, I am blank. I could have been Yamantaka or Vajrayogini, but instead, I see Venerable Phil. Why? Because of my karma. My karma could instead force me to see Yamantaka, or it could force me to see Vajrayogini. But now it forces me to see Venerable Phil. Venerable Phil is projected on a blank form, an empty form, meaning it has no nature of its own. I see Venerable Phil. Why? Because my karma forces me to see that projected on a blank form. Now, none of this is bad in itself. When a Buddha looks in the mirror, he immediately thinks me, you know, and he's forced to see what he sees by his karma. This way of perceiving me is a valid perception. It's a tsema. So where do things go wrong? Well, the second way of perceiving a self, myself, for example, is seeing myself as self-existent and believing myself to be self-existent. So I see Venerable Phil in the mirror, and I think that Venerable Phil is self-existent, and then that I can gain happiness by manipulating things that have no relationship to Venerable Phil to give Venerable Phil happiness. This view is incorrect. I can't arrange anything to give Venerable Phil happiness. I project Venerable Phil onto a blank form, and I can't give this projection happiness by trying to give the blank form happiness. What I wind up doing is doing wrong deeds in order to give this blank form, which I project to be Venerable Phil, happiness. Venerable Phil is a misperception of my nature. And that is ignorance. I think the chocolate cake will make me happy rather than trying to make other people happy, for example, by giving them chocolate cake. I see myself in the wrong way. I try to make myself happy by giving myself the right job or the right partner, if I weren't a monk, right? Or a high income, something like that. And this kind of thinking is ignorant of the nature of karma. What I have to do instead is create a projection of a happy Venerable Phil. And according to the laws of karma, that means making others happy. So there's a double whammy here. I misperceive the nature of reality, and I misperceive the nature of karma. A person in this state has not yet reached the path of seeing. And then the third way of perceiving a self is somebody who has seen emptiness and doesn't believe in self-existent, but sees the self as self-existent. So this is what happens after you've had a direct perception of emptiness. You no longer believe in self-existence, but you still see yourself as self-existent. That's what appears to you. So I look in the mirror, and I still see a self-existent Venerable Phil. I don't believe in that appearance, but the appearance is still there. And finally, the fourth way of perceiving a self, myself, would be somebody who no longer sees or believes the self to be self-existent. So people who see themselves in ways 1, 2, and 3 will trigger karma and a rebirth at the time of death. You will perceive yourself and will wish yourself to be happy and to not come to an end. You don't want yourself to come to an end. This is an ignorant perception of yourself, and it will lead to a rebirth in samsara. So with the path of seeing, you'll no longer believe that you are self-existent. But nonetheless, yourself still appears to you as self-existent. And it's the job of the path of familiarization, the fourth path, to develop an idea of selflessness of yourself in your mind stream that can withstand the terror of your last moments so that you do not fall back to grasping to me or mine or this self. You aren't afraid that it's going to go away, that that self-existent self is going to go away, because it has never, ever existed in the first place as a self-existent self. So this is the quality of the fourth way of seeing yourself. And that's developed by the path of familiarization that allows you to stop rebirth in samsara. Meaning it allows you to stop rebirths forced on you by your karma. So I hope by now that you appreciate the difference between believing in a self-existent self and seeing yourself as self-existent. It appears that you have to get rid of the view or the perception of yourself as self-existent in order to leave samsara. The trigger for link number 9 and 10 is grasping to the self-existent self. And simply believing that the self is not self-existent isn't enough to stop that trigger. So after the path of seeing, after your first direct perception of emptiness, you still are subject to rebirths by the force of your karma at the time of dying. And you have to eliminate that in order to not be forced into rebirths. So proof number 10 leaps into the idea of your mind traveling across lifetimes and then to what it is that causes those successive lifetimes. So that is the class today, and I'm sure you've got lots of questions.
Hello, this is Christian from Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I have a question. You were describing the process of not grasping to the me and my and the process of passing away. And I would like you to repeat this because I feel that I got a glimpse of it, but I would like to hear it again.
Catch that last part.
I would like to hear it again. You know, I don't have a question about it. I would just like to hear your words again regarding this moment of grasping, like when you're dying, of grasping to the me and my. And you were describing a technique, the technique of getting over this grasping. And I heard it, but I couldn't repeat it. I can't repeat it in my mind.
Right. Okay. the grasping we do all the time. It's the reason we get angry or really, really happy. Food that you like or people you like or things that you like. We grasp to them as being able to make us happy. It's the same way we grasp to things, and this is kind of insane, really, that make us unhappy, the mind goes to them and grasps to them as being self-existent, meaning that they have the ability in and of themselves to affect our happiness, either positively or negatively. The grasping part is our perception of them as coming from their own side. They have a nature of their own. The chocolate cake is good from its own side. Therefore, I might hurt somebody to get a piece of it. Or the yelling boss or, you know, somebody you don't like has the ability from their own side to make you unhappy. And therefore, you will do something, maybe in some way to harm them, to stop that from happening. So we do this all the time. We don't really think that we're grasping to a me at that point, because we're focused on the other object, you know, the object of the mind, not on me. But at the time of death, that becomes very much focused on me, because we are losing. We are understanding that the me is going out of existence. And we don't want that to happen. And that intensifies. In what actually happens is all the karma that we've generated during this life that has not ripened begins to ripen in those few seconds. It may be longer than a few seconds. And that karma, which is now ripening by the force of our grasping to this me, that's the trigger, is what becomes our next rebirth. So if we've been really, really kind people and helped others, that will put us into a good rebirth, like as a human or one of the gods, one of the god realms. If we've been not nice to people, if we've hurt them in some way, or if we've disrespected people, done disrespectful things, or killed people, that will put us into a lower realm of existence, as an animal, as a hungry ghost, or as a hell being. What we are doing in these final few seconds is generating the kind of mind or the kind of perceptions we are going to have after we leave the in-between state, when we have the rebirth and our next existence. And I hope that helps a little bit.
Yes, that helps a little bit. And what would you suggest in these few last seconds?
Meditate. Doing the courses will get you familiar with the way this works and what we have to learn, and it will begin to get you in touch with what the self is. The self is a hard thing to grasp. We know it's there. We don't think about it. We don't analyze it at all. But nonetheless, we hold on to the self. You know, all of our problems is trying to take care of this self, you know, and we don't take care of other people. It turns out that kindness is the currency of the universe. And we have to develop that. We have to become selfish in the opposite way. We have to really understand deeply, and you'll get this in courses, a little bit in course 7 and a lot in 10, 11, and 12. Master Shanti Davis says that all the suffering in the world comes from trying to take care of myself. All the happiness in the world comes from trying to take care of others. So we become selfish in a different way. In order for me to be happy, I have to make others happy. And I don't kind of happy. I have to care for them and take care of them.
Thank you.
I have a question regarding the triggering of the karma. That means when I reach the state of an arhat in one eon of years, even if I have karma left over and I have removed my desire, I won't have to take rebirth.
Left over at that point. There's no karma that forces you into rebirth. Let me put it that way. On the path of familiarization, you remove one by one all of your mental afflictions and all the seeds for them so that they will never occur again. And when you've gotten rid of the seeds for the one remaining mental affliction you have left, then you are an arhat. You are in nirvana. You will never, ever be forced to take rebirth due to your karma. Now, in the lower track, that's nirvana.
Okay.
Higher track, somewhere along Bodhisattva level 7, of the 10 levels.
That would mean that as long as I have karmic seeds, I also have desire to trigger it.
As long as you... The karmic seeds... even for an arhat, somebody who's reached nirvana, okay, that there's a little bit of self-cherishing left when you reach nirvana. The mental afflictions are gone. Self-cherishing really isn't a mental affliction. But it's very, very weak. All right. And, of course, you've got all the seeds of wisdom that you've gained in the path of familiarization. So that's there. For bodhisattvas, they can, once they've reached, the eighth level, eighth of ten, they can choose to take rebirths, for example, in the hell realms, so they can go there to help other beings. They can choose that. They aren't forced by it. They're not yet Buddhas, which is their goal. They're not settling for just nirvana. You can also do that in meditation before you reach nirvana, and that will be part of your practice as bodhisattvas. Does that help?
Yes, thank you.